But we have like exactly 1 o'clock, and we might have some other folks come in, but I want to go ahead and get started so that we can, you know, we can get through everything. And with a, you know, a small group like we have, I just, you know, want to encourage you all to ask questions as, you know, as we go throughout this. I'm one of those people who probably always has too much to talk about, because there's just so much that I really enjoy sharing with couples. But you know, I can go as slow or as quickly as you all want me to, and you know, I have some questions for discussion at the end for you all to talk about among yourselves, and hopefully we'll get to some of that. I will tell you, I believe, or at least I had asked Carissa to make the link for this Prezi available, and so you should be able afterwards. I don't have a handout with all of these slides, but you should be able, if you have that link at any time, to go and look through it again. So, you know, don't worry about trying to capture everything or to write everything down. Even though you don't have a full handout, you can always go back to that link and access it anytime you want to, if you want to look through things again. I should probably, I guess, start by telling you a little bit about myself, introducing myself, but I'm Jamie Goff, and I am the chair of the Department of Marriage and Family Studies at ACU, and I'm also the associate dean of the graduate school at ACU. I've been teaching in the Marriage and Family Therapy program there for 11 years, so I'm finishing up my 11th year of being on the faculty at ACU, and it's been a great over a decade, which is always seems a little crazy. So, I'm from West Virginia originally, so a little bit closer to Atlanta than Abilene. But I'm from West Virginia originally. Did my undergraduate work at Ohio Valley College or University, if some of you are familiar with that. And then went out to ACU to do my master's degree. Did my PhD at Michigan State. Did a postdoc at the University of Kentucky, and then went back to ACU to be on the faculty there. I'm married to Eric. My husband's name is Eric, and he is a CPA, and so he's busy right now until April 15th. He's a tax accountant, so that's what he does. And so he, I believe, is at the office preparing tax returns as we speak. But we've been married for 14 years, and I always have to tell you though, but we've been married for 14 years, but we've been together for 18 years. So we have to get credit for those 4 long years of dating that we had before we got married. So I'm so glad that, you know, all of you are here, and hopefully this will be helpful to you. You know, I titled this this session In Weakness Made Strong, Strengthening Your Marriage Through Vulnerability, and I've heard several of you joke as you were coming in, and Joel joked about it this morning, and Tracy was joking about it a bit, but that word vulnerability is uncomfortable for a lot of people, but vulnerability and weakness, I was just kind of scrolling through this morning because I know it's there, but I wanted to see how frequently it's there, and especially Paul. In his epistles, talks quite a bit how it's in weakness that God's power is most displayed. And of course, we see that displayed in Jesus' example, and then Paul talks about that frequently too. And I really think, and I'll talk about this on the panel in the 2:30 session, but I really think that the strongest leaders are those who are willing to be the most vulnerable. And really where you develop the capacity to be vulnerable is in your intimate relationships. And so I really think that our intimate relationships, of course not all of us are married, but I'm assuming all of us in here are, but those intimate relationships, whether it be your spouse or your closest friend or God, those intimate relationships provide the security that we all need that enable us to be effective leaders in whatever context we find ourselves taking on leadership roles. And so if we're not willing to be vulnerable and to nurture the type of security that only can come through vulnerability in our intimate relationships, it really sets us up for some difficulties in other leadership roles in another context. And I really truly believe that. And in fact, there's quite a bit of research that shows that to be the case. So I really think that this is an important topic for church leaders to think about and to really nurture and protect their intimate relationships, and that will make them better church leaders. And so that's what we're going to talk about a bit, is how do you, specifically your marriage, what are the barriers, and then how can you strengthen that and make yourself able to be more vulnerable. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about vulnerability, what it is, what some of the barriers to vulnerability, especially in our marriages, are, and then how we might overcome barriers to vulnerability. So, as we start, just throw in some words to complete these sentences. So, vulnerability is what?
Bearing all.
Bearing all.
Openness.
Transparency.
Transparency. Yeah. How does vulnerability feel? Vulnerability feels
scary.
Scary. Yeah. Very risky. Intimidating.
Weak.
Yeah, all of those words are often used to describe vulnerability and to describe how it feels to be in a vulnerable position. And I mean, those are common, common themes that I hear whenever I have these types of conversations with people. So really, this is how I would define vulnerability. So we think about the transparency and openness that's required when we're vulnerable with others, but you all mentioned risk. There's a lot of uncertainty involved with vulnerability, right? Because when you're vulnerable, you really have no way of knowing how someone is going to respond to that vulnerability. It's emotional exposure. You're opening yourself up to others. However, despite those really scary things associated with vulnerability, vulnerability is also the birthplace of love, of belonging, joy, courage, empathy, and creativity. And so if you aren't vulnerable especially with your spouse, does your spouse really know you? The answer's no.
Good one for that. I use on Wednesday nights. Don't everybody all answer one.
Yeah, exactly. My trick is you have to give people 10 seconds. But if you are not able to be vulnerable in relationships with other people, they don't ever really know you. And so most of us, we hide our vulnerability and we kind of keep our fears and those, what we would consider to be kind of those weak places within ourselves, we keep those hidden because we're afraid of rejection, but then we never experience true acceptance if we're not able to reveal those things, right? So it's kind of this maddening cycle that we get stuck in. And so it really is through vulnerability that we are able to really truly experience love, acceptance, and joy, and these sorts of things. Vulnerability is also a source of hope and empathy, and I think especially for our church communities, it can be a source of accountability and authenticity. And so without vulnerability in our faith communities, we really don't have the capability of being accountable to one another and having authentic relationships and really creating community. And it's the same in our intimate relationships in our marriage as well. There are a lot of myths associated with vulnerability, and I think these myths are very much culturally mediated. So, our culture, American culture, very much is, it's kind of a pull yourself up by your bootstraps type of culture, right? I mean, we're independent, we don't need anybody else, we can do it on our own. It's that Lone Ranger mentality that's really prevalent in our culture. And so we think of that as being strong. Like, that's what strength is. Strength is not needing anybody else. It's being able to do it all on your own. But I think one of the biggest myths associated with vulnerability is that vulnerability is weakness. Because it takes a lot of courage to be vulnerable. A lot of courage. much more courage to be vulnerable with someone than it does to kind of have that, you know, heroic, I don't need anybody else, Lone Ranger sort of perspective on life. And so vulnerability isn't weakness at all. Vulnerability really is, in some ways, the strongest thing that you can do. Some people say, you know, I don't do vulnerability. That's not who I am. I don't do it. I don't like it. And they may do a fairly good job of kind of hiding their vulnerabilities, but we all have vulnerabilities. And you know, if we're being honest with ourselves, we know that, although some people like to deny it. Vulnerability is letting it all hang out. That's not necessarily the case either. When we hear that word vulnerability, we have these pictures of in our minds of, you know, someone who like just shares too much. Have y'all ever, you know, met someone and you're like, whoa, that's a little bit TMI, right? That's a little bit too much information. That's not what vulnerability requires. You know, there is, it's smart to be selective in your vulnerability. And so, you know, being vulnerable is about choosing trusted people in your life with whom you're going to be vulnerable. It's not necessarily about just letting it, you know, letting it all hang out and sharing everything about yourself with everyone. And then another myth that's very prevalent in our culture is that we can go it alone. We don't need anybody else. I can take care of myself. And that's really not true. Those who do try to do that, that's a way that they're coping with their vulnerability, but they're usually not functioning very well if they're really honest with themselves and others. So a question I think that relates to this and is especially important for couples is, how does our desire for self-protection inhibit intimacy?
Yeah. And you're afraid, like you said before, you're afraid of rejection or disappointment. Not that you could, but they would be disappointed in you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so if you're not open, then they don't really know you. You don't have that intimacy in your relationship. Grover, it looked like you were about to say something a minute ago.
I thought an analogy to military operations. If you go inside the walls of something, you're dead, because you just become surrounded and you're attacked and they destroy you. And the best way to avoid that is to make yourself vulnerable, to go outside the walls of some defensive position and be, this doesn't quite sound right, but to be on the attack, to actually be active and do it instead of going inside the walls.
Yeah. And so, well, that speaks to the risk that's involved in being vulnerable. I mean, you have to take the risk and you have to put yourself out there. And sometimes you have to make the first move rather than waiting for someone else to come to you. Yeah. So I think that analogy does apply in some ways. Any other thoughts about how our desires for self-protection inhibit intimacy?
The question seems interesting because I don't think as much as a desire for self-protection as much as a natural tendency towards self-protection.
And
that almost answers the question. It's just nature of beings to protect themselves from attack. And so make yourself vulnerable, make you subject to attack.
Yes, and we're going to talk about a little bit more about that. I started to kind of respond to that a little bit, but then I'm jumping ahead. So, but yes, you know, we do have that kind of, you know, just our brains are wired in such a way that we have mechanisms in our brains that are always scanning our environment for danger and for threats. And so it is a natural, it is a kind of instinctual, biological, natural response that we have is to protect ourselves. But sometimes that does, I think, shift from being a natural response to a need that has arisen out of our experiences and interactions with other people. So we'll talk about that some. But so I want to, you know, spend some time talking about kind of where do, like, the roots of self-protection, where do these come from? What are the barriers to vulnerability and connection in our intimate relationships? And so I think there are really three areas, or three barriers, essentially, to vulnerability and connection. One has to do with early childhood experiences that determine our attachment styles. And so I'll talk about each of these in a few minutes, but all of us have a kind of a general way of interacting with other people based on our very earliest childhood experiences. We'll talk about this a little bit more. That can be shifted, so your expectations of people can be changed throughout life based on new experiences. However, they're fairly stable over time. And so a lot of what we expect from a spouse is many times defined by what we've experienced previously to that relationship. We learn about whether or not people are trustworthy in general. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Another barrier to vulnerability and connection has to do with the way that our brains work. And it relates to the first barrier, but some of us have a difficult time integrating our brains, whether it's right, left, or up, down, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. And then finally, a lot of us have attachment injuries in our current relationship. So things that have happened throughout the history of our relationship, times when we've not been there for one another, times when there's been a need that you've, you know, made a bid for a connection or made a request that hasn't been met, and that kind of, it creates a wound in your relationship. And so sometimes there are things in the current relationship that inhibit vulnerability and inhibit intimacy. So first, I'll talk a bit about attachment style. So these early childhood experiences that really color how we view the world and how we view everybody else around us. There are four attachment styles. The first one is secure, and then avoidant, anxious, and disorganized are all types of insecure attachment. Any of you, like, teachers or therapists or anything like that, where you have some knowledge of an attachment style, or, yeah, have kind of done some of this in terms of developmental psych? So people who have secure attachment styles, their core belief is that other people are trustworthy and I'm worthy of love, acceptance, and belonging. So in childhood, people who develop a secure attachment style, in childhood, generally, their needs are met. Their parents, their primary caregivers are responsive to them. You know, when they were an infant and they cried, someone was there, met their needs, fed them when they were hungry, soothed them when they were upset. So they learned that, okay, people are trustworthy. When I cry, when I have a need, my caretaker is going to respond and they're going to take care of me, and I'm safe because of that. And so that really colors how you begin to feel about yourself and the core beliefs that you have about yourself and others very early on in your life. I mean, we're talking like within the first 18 months to 2 years. And so so if you have that experience in early childhood, you have this belief that other people are trustworthy and that you're worthy of their love and acceptance. And the resulting actions of people who have secure attachments, they have the ability to pay attention to both their own and others' feelings. So those who are securely attached are very emotionally intelligent. They're aware of themselves, but they're also very empathetic, so they can read emotions in other people. They're socially, emotionally, and cognitively integrated, so they do a really good job of emotional regulation. So even when they have those, like, fight, flight, or freeze responses, they're able to kind of stop before they react, and, you know, let their prefrontal cortex engage and think about, okay, is this really a situation in which I need to be this afraid, or am I maybe overreacting here? So they're able, they're integrated, their brains are integrated in a way that they can process a lot of information and make sense of it effectively. They're cooperative in relationships with other people, but they're not a pushover. So people who are have a secure attachment style are assertive, but they're also willing to compromise when necessary. They approach conflict with curiosity. So when there's a problem or there's conflict in relationships, it's like, this is interesting. What is this about? You know, why are we having this conflict? I want to understand your point of view. So they approach it with curiosity, and they even see conflict as an opportunity for growth many times. And they're good at both leading and following. So when they're called upon to be leaders, they can step into those roles, but they also recognize when it's time for them to step back from a leadership role and let someone else take over, and they feel very comfortable in both places. And that can be in a, in an intimate relationship, in your family context, and also in larger contexts like the church, for example. Really about 60% of the population fits into a secure attachment style. So the majority of the population develops a secure attachment style. But we then have three insecure attachment styles. One is avoidant, and people who develop an avoidant attachment style in infancy, in those first years of life, they experience a lack of their needs being met. So many times, the best example, I just remember watching like a Dateline or something like that, like one of those television news shows, and they were in Romania. And they were going into orphanages. They were talking about kind of this crisis, orphans crisis in Romania. And they were going into these orphanages in these large rooms about this size, full of cribs with babies, with silence. Okay, those infants are developing avoidant attachment style in that very moment, because why would a baby not cry? Because they've cried before, and eventually they learn that no one is coming. So why would I waste, it's like, why waste energy crying? There's no point in this, because when I cry, no one comes to take care of me, no one meets my needs. It's not that necessarily people are trying to make that happen, but when you have a crisis like that, and a lot of orphans, people just can't, there aren't enough people to meet their needs. And so those are the types of experiences that people who develop avoidant attachment styles have in their infancy. And so because of that, their core belief becomes others cannot be trusted. I have to depend on myself for everything. They don't ask for other people to meet their needs ever, because they learn that that doesn't happen. So resulting actions, these individuals are very literal in the way that they process information. They highly value words, but they miss the context of nonverbal communication. And so we'll talk about the brain here in a minute after this slide, but these people are very left brain dominant, people who develop an avoidant attachment style. And when it comes to the communication, if you kind of think of an interaction with a couple, someone who is very literal in the way that they process, like let's say a couple comes home at the end of the day and, a husband says to his wife, "How was your day?" And she goes, "It was fine." Okay, so that says, was her day fine? No. But someone who has a very avoidant attachment style and who processes words very literally but has a difficult time reading nonverbal communication is not going to follow up on that. They're not going to say, "Are you sure? It doesn't seem like your day was okay. Tell me more about that." But a person who has an attachment style like this is going to be like, "Oh, okay, that's fine. Her day was fine. No need to follow up," because they just miss the nonverbal communication. They believe that feelings don't matter and that feelings should be ignored or avoided. So, it doesn't do me any good to express my feelings because no one's listening to them anyway. And so people who have this style tend to disown their feelings, and they really try to keep distance from that. Conflict should be avoided as well, because, again, there's no sense in it. I'm just going to fix it on my own. Fighting is a waste of time, and they have a difficult time being emotionally connected to other people. Anxious, people who are anxiously attached, In childhood, these individuals have caretakers who are very inconsistent in the way that they respond. So they never know what's going to happen when they have a need. Eight times out of 10, their caretaker may not respond to their need, but then all of a sudden on the ninth time when they cry, the person does respond. And so they think, maybe they will respond. So they'll continue. It's kind of an intermittent reinforcement idea that, it's the strongest, intermittent reinforcement is the strongest predictor of behavior. We'll keep behavior going. And so what happens, though, for people who have that experience in childhood where there's really inconsistent responsiveness to their needs is that their core belief becomes other people are capable, because sometimes they did. So it's not that they can't. They are capable, but they're unwilling or unreliable in meeting my needs. Therefore, there's something wrong with me. I'm unworthy. I'm flawed. There's a reason why people don't respond to my needs and don't take care of me when I need it. So they make it about themselves. Their resulting actions, anxiously attached folks are very right brain dominant. So they're overwhelmed with emotional experience and have a difficult time processing cognitively what they're experiencing emotionally. They tend to be very clingy in relationships, overly sensitive to their own feelings, but unable to process the feelings of others. So they're not very good at empathy, because they're so overwhelmed with their own emotions that they have a difficult time being empathetic with other people and seeing what other people are experiencing. They're preoccupied with relationships, and when their needs aren't met, many times they'll respond with angry protests. So their response to needs not being met sometimes seems exaggerated, or they're going over the top with it. Finally, disorganized insecure attachment. People who develop disorganized attachment styles are usually those who have experienced pretty severe abuse and neglect as children. A disorganized style is a combination of avoidant and anxious. It's difficult to tell sometimes what's going to happen with them. Many times these folks are diagnosed with personality disorders. And so their core belief is that the world is unsafe, it's full of danger, and I'm flawed and unworthy of being alive. So it kind of takes it a step further. Their resulting actions, they swing between avoidant and anxious behaviors, they're very inconsistent, and they tend to have severe mental illnesses and personality disorders that they're diagnosed with. So even though about 60% of us kind of fit into that secure attachment style most of the time, we all tend to, because we kind of have these attachment behaviors, we all tend to, when we're under stress, look either a little bit more avoidant or a little bit more anxious in the way that we approach our emotions and interact in our relationships. So kind of based on these descriptions, since this might be a little time for self-disclosure, I get avoidant. So when I'm under stress, and or there's conflict in my relationship with my partner, I tend to withdraw. I really withdraw into myself. I want to avoid the conflict. I don't want to deal with it. That's kind of that under stress. That's what I tend to do. Although I think I would mostly classify myself as a securely attached person. So how many avoidance? Usually, avoidance. Any anxious folks? Yeah. A little bit of both. Oh, well, disorganized is usually pretty. And we all use kind of these strategies, at different times, but we tend to lean toward either avoidant or anxious strategies when we're in distress, when we feel threatened, especially in our intimate relationships. And so sometimes it's helpful to realize that and kind of think about where that came from. And for me, I had I had a good childhood, I had good experiences, have good relationships with my parents, my family was still very much one in which we really didn't talk about feelings, we didn't express our feelings, ever. Which is funny, I became a therapist, but you know what they say about people who become therapists. Yeah. Yes. And you mentioned that. It's so true. I did a class at a church in Abilene on some of these themes, and I talked about how different religious denominations and faith communities almost have like attachment styles. And yes, Church of Christ, we are avoidance. Generally speaking, historically, I would say, you know, we kind of tend to take this avoidant type of approach to how we do things. So yeah, and cultures have that too. I mean, I think American culture tends to be a little bit, as a whole, although obviously there can't really say American culture. There's too many subcultures there. But yeah, yeah. So it's helpful to kind of see yourself and be self-aware and think about where you fall and what your natural reactions are and where those come from. Because a lot of times we see we view our partner as like the enemy when we're in distress or when we feel threatened or in danger. But many times that experience or that expectation that they're going to be rejecting or dismissive comes from somewhere else. And it comes from expectations that have been developed based on previous relationships and other interactions. And so it's helpful to think about that. And I'll bring this all together too. So, but any questions about these in terms of attachment styles? One thing that's interesting I forgot to mention is that many times we find ourselves partnered with someone who has kind of an opposite strategy. And so you can see where that creates some conflict in marriages, right? So if you tend to be a little bit more avoidant when you're in distress, but your partner tends to be more anxious, what happens when during conflict or during times of high stress, when you have someone who's avoidant and someone who is who's more anxious? What can you see happening? Any ideas or guesses? Yeah, so the anxious person is kind of like, I need you, I need you, I need you. Like, you know, pay attention to me. And what does that make a avoidant person do? I need to get out of here. So they want to run away. And then as they run away, what happens? It heightens this person even more. And so then they chase more. And so you kind of get into this maddening cycle when you have opposite strategies. And so it's helpful to understand that and see if that might be something that's going on in your relationship.
But couldn't it be if you both have the same?
Yeah.
Like if you're both avoiding, you never resolve.
Right, you kind of end up, yes, you end up being just, you know, a lot of things end up getting swept under the rug and they end up being ignored, but they're still there. And so they begin to affect you in ways that you don't realize and make you, you know, really vulnerable, or your relationship really vulnerable, because you're not connecting around those things. When you have two partners who are highly anxious together, they tend to be highly conflictual. So couples, you know, that seem to fight all the time. And many times when there's violence in relationships, sometimes that's, you have two highly anxious individuals in relationship with one another, and it escalates to that point because they're both kind of looking for something and being very demanding and having angry outbursts in the way that they're trying to go about getting their needs met. So all of these are things that we do to try to get our needs met, but it doesn't work. So avoidant, I mean, people who are avoidant, if you really start kind of digging down, they're afraid, they tend to be afraid of rejection, they tend to have fears of inadequacy. They often feel like they can't measure up, you know, to what their partner's expecting of them. And so they withdraw because they feel like they're not good enough. And people who have kind of anxious attachment types of behaviors, they have fears of being abandoned, and they fear loneliness. They feel very insecure in their relationships, and so that makes them kind of go after, try to get those needs met in overwhelming ways to someone who is more avoidant. So there are strategies that we use, but they are not effective strategies to get our needs met in relationship to one another. So brain integration is related to attachment style, because those nobody talks about nature and nurture anymore. Like, you know, if you ever took like a, you know, if you were in college or even in high school and you took a general psych class, you know, the question is it nature or nurture? And now we know the answer is yes, because it's all about epigenetics. So we do have genetic predispositions to different types of behaviors and illnesses, both mental and physical illnesses. We have those genetic predispositions, but it's really our environment that turns off and activates. And it's those intimate relationships and really those very early parent-child relationships that kind of activate those different genetic predispositions, if you will. And so as we're relating in infancy to our primary caretaker, our brain is developing very quickly. And so those things happen hand in hand with one another. Our brains don't develop in isolation from our environment. They're both happening at the same time. So you can think about your brain in kind of two ways. You can think about your brain as right and left, and you can also think about your brain as top down. And so the right-left organization of the brain, the right brain, we tend to think of the right brain as it's like the emotional side of the brain. And so the right brain provides an integrated map of your body. So it's the side of your brain that gives you a sense of your body. So like with amputees, for example, when they've had a leg amputated, but they can still feel it. That's their right brain because it's always given them a sense of their body and where things are. The right brain is responsible for nonverbal communication. It provides the holistic sense of your experience and gives you cues about the social and emotional context. So when you walk into like a crowded room or a party or a dinner party, something like that, or even a church, and you get a sense, right, of the environment, you kind of get a sense of the social environment, the atmosphere of the room, the mood of the room, that's your right brain taking in those cues. It helps you to feel connected to both yourself and to others through multiple sensory modalities. And the thing is that the right brain is fully operational at birth. So at birth, your right brain is taking in a lot of sensory data. However, your left brain doesn't really start to kick into development until about 18 months. So in those first 18 months of life, before your left brain is really coming along, your right brain is taking in all kinds of data. And it's experiencing all sorts of different things. And so it's experiencing whether or not, you know, your caretaker is responsive, or whether or not you're being fed and comforted and soothed. It's storing all of that information, but you can't make sense of it because your left brain isn't processing yet. So the left brain begins to develop 18 to 24 months. It's responsible for language as well as for linear and logical processing. It makes sense of the data that's coming in through the right hemisphere. So it helps to give meaning to what your right brain is experiencing. The thing is that we also have, when it comes to memory, we have implicit and explicit memory. Implicit memory is stored in the right brain. And implicit memory is you don't remember an event, you remember a sense, or you remember an emotional experience, but it's not necessarily tied to an event. Explicit memory, that's when last week we went, on vacation here, and these are the things that happened. That's explicit memory. Which one do you think is more powerful? Implicit memory is much more powerful than explicit memory in terms of predicting what our future behavior will be. When we think of, I remember at one time in my life kind of thinking of memories as almost being like a filing cabinet in your brain, you know, and you have like this filing cabinet full of all of these events that have happened in your life. But that's really not what memory is at all. In fact, your brain has no sense of the past, has no sense of the future. Your brain only understands and processes the present. And so when you experience a memory, what is happening is that the same neural connections that were triggered in a previous event or experience are being triggered in the present. Does that make sense? So it's like your brain forms like a Grand Canyon. You have a Grand Canyon in your brain, and when you have an experience that was frightening or where you were in a threatening situation or you experienced rejection or abandonment or something like that, you store that in implicit memory. You make neural connections in your brain, and then if you experience something at another time in your life that is similar to that and triggers the same types of feelings, then it triggers those same neural connections to be strengthened even more. So if you have multiple experiences like that, it's like that groove in your brain becomes deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And then that's why you always, then in the future experiences, you predict and expect what's going to happen because that Grand Canyon is really deep. So it's like it can't go anywhere else, right? The water is going to go the path of least resistance, and that's the path of least resistance. And so that's why implicit memory is so powerful, because it happens before we even know it's happening. And then, so right and left brain. So people who have secure relationships in infancy and in early childhood, they have integration of those two sides, hemispheres of the brain. They take in what the right brain is processing, and they're able to make sense of it with their left brain. But like we said, people who have insecure styles, if you're avoidant, you tend to ignore everything that your right brain is telling you and only pay attention to what you can see and understand very linearly. And if you have an anxious attachment style, you're overwhelmed with what you're experiencing in your right brain and overwhelmed with the emotional data, and you can't make sense of it using your left brain adequately. So integration, brain integration is really important. And we also, our brains are also organized top down. So if everybody does this, everybody make a fist like this, thumb under, yeah, like this. This is a good model of your brain. And so this is your brain stem, your wrist here. And this is, you know, what's often referred to as the reptilian brain, because this is the part of the brain that we have in common with all animals. So reptiles, mammals, all animals have that brain stem. It consists of the stem and the cerebellum. And it's really what takes in all of that sensory information. So your brain stem is responsible for scanning the environment, where are there cues of danger, where are there cues of threat. Your limbic system, so if you lift up your fingers, your thumb represents your limbic system. So your pleasure centers are in your limbic system, and your limbic system is also where your fight, flight, or freeze response lies. And so, you know, if you sense danger and threat, if your brainstem is sensing danger and threat, then it triggers that fight, flight, or freeze response. And then this is your fingers over the top of your thumb represent your neocortex. It's the highest level of our brains. And so this is where we're able to cognitively process what's happening. And of course, that's what's unique to us as human beings, our prefrontal cortex especially. So again, those who have security in their intimate relationships, they're able to, that's all integrated. So rather than being immediately, one of my favorite neuroscientists, he calls it flipping your lid. So people who have security in their intimate relationships, they are able to keep their lid closed. So even when they experience threat, they're able to activate their prefrontal cortex to process what that means and whether or not they really do need to fight, flight, or freeze, or whether or not it's not really that dangerous, I can engage. But people who have insecurity in their intimate relationships, they often what he calls flip their lid. So their prefrontal cortex is disengaged and they're being driven by their limbic system. So they're just fight, flight, freeze. So again, it's really important to understand how our brains work and to think about whether or not we have brain integration. The one thing that we know about our brains though now is that they're neuroplastic. And so we used to think that brain development was finished at like early 20s. We now know that's not the case at all. Our brains can change throughout the course of our entire lives. And our brains are always developing and developing new neural connections. And so even if you had a difficult childhood, even if you had experiences where your needs weren't met in childhood or in previous relationships, even if that was your experience, you can change your brain. So through repeated experiences of being validated and reassured and loved and accepted, your brain paths can change. You can kind of fill in that one Grand Canyon that, you know, is formed by negative experiences and create a new one that's influenced by newer positive experiences. And then finally, the last barrier is this idea of attachment injuries. And so attachment injuries are wounds that exist in your current relationship. Many times these are relationship traumas. And generally speaking, they happen as a result of disconnection at times of high fragility, high need, loss, illness, trauma, or uncertainty. And so an example comes to mind from a therapy experience that I had. As I was, you know, I had a client and a woman came by herself for a first session. And as she was talking, you know, she was experiencing some depression, but, you know, she was talking about how dissatisfied she was in her relationship, in her marriage. I was like, well, maybe it might be a good idea to bring your husband in for the next session. And so she did. And he came for a few sessions, but I just knew. I was like, there is a serious disconnection here. I mean, she was very emotionally disconnected from him. And I thought, there's something that she's not telling me. There's something here that I'm not aware of that's happened, you know, and I'm trying to figure out what it is. Well, at one of their sessions, he couldn't come or something. I don't remember why. So she was by herself again. And so it's like, I just feel like there's something there that's, you know, blocking you from being able to connect. And I'm trying to figure out what that is. Is there something that significant in your relationship or in your life that you haven't told me about? And she proceeded to tell me that when they were newly married, you know, she was probably in her, you know, early to mid-20s, she was having really severe health problems, and she'd gone to the doctor several times, was having a lot of tests run, but the possibilities for what it could be were really scary, and some were like degenerative disorders and, you know, fatal, life-threatening sorts of things, and she was really terrified during that time. Before she got her test results back. So during that time of waiting, you know, she was terrified. She thought, you know, and they were also telling her, it was, you know, she probably wasn't going to be having children and she might have this degenerative disorder. And, you know, so she's, of course, just, you know, just a mess, emotionally a mess, understandably so. And she told me, she said, I came home from, you know, a doctor's appointment one day. And I, you know, made it to the stairs. I was on my, you know, way up to the bedroom or whatever to do whatever. I was on my way upstairs, and I just, like, collapsed on the stairs. I was so emotionally overwhelmed. I just, like, collapsed on the stairs, and I was sobbing, you know, crying. I couldn't, like, pull it together. And my husband, you know, came by, and he saw me on the stairs just sobbing, crying, you know, terrified. And he said, pull it together. There's no reason to catastrophize this. We don't know what it's going to be. You're probably going to be just fine. And just walked on. And she's just like lying there on the stairs, crying, sobbing, weeping. And she told me, she said, in that moment, I said, never again. Never again am I going to let him see me that way, in that vulnerable of a state where I need him to just hold me and just let me become undone, you know. She said, I just decided then, never again. He's not capable of it. He doesn't care about me. So she made a decision. And that had been like 15 or 20 years previous. I mean, when she came to see me, they were still married, but it was like 15, 20 years later. And you know, he, talking to him later, he had no idea that that it had that type, that she still remembered that and that it was so powerful to her. And he wasn't trying to be mean. He wasn't trying to be dismissive. But that's what he thought he needed to say in order to help her in that moment. But clearly it wasn't. And so that's an example of an attachment injury. Something that happens in a relationship like that that's a trauma where you feel like, okay, I can't trust this person. And it usually happens at a time of really high fragility for one or the other person. Miscarriages are common events that often result in attachment wounds. And this is attachment injuries, and I've just kind of seen that pattern in my therapeutic work. So there are times in our relationships where we really need to be there for each other in emotionally significant ways, and when we're not, it can have long-lasting consequences. And so usually during these times there are unanswered bids for connection and bonding, and unfortunately those end up destroying safety and trust, and sometimes the other person isn't even aware that safety and trust has been destroyed. Injuries are often unacknowledged, but they end up having a powerful influence on the entire trajectory of the relationship, as it did in the example that I shared. If you have these types of experiences in your relationship, they can't be avoided. I mean, they really do have to be brought into the light, and they have to be reprocessed. They have to be talked about. You can't leave them in the past because they will continue to affect your relationship. And we know that. And we know that even from doing brain scans and functional MRIs of people and how their brains react to their partners. And if these sorts of things have happened, their brains react to their partners as if they're a threat. So it's necessary to go back to these events and reprocess them if you haven't, because they'll continue to affect the relationship. Okay, so those are the barriers. If we're unaware of our attachment style and we, are not working on our relationship to develop more security, if we don't have right, left, and top-down brain integration, if we're not aware of how our brain's processing and we don't engage both our right and left brains, that can be a barrier, and then those attachment injuries can be barriers to vulnerability. However, the good news, like I already mentioned, is that change is possible. And change, and this is all of the research on change, how change happens in therapy, how people make changes in their lives, it all points to the same idea. Change takes place through experience, so it has to be a felt experience. You have to have an emotional response to something in order for change to happen. It takes place through experience. That experience is mediated by the security of one's attachment to another person. And so you really cannot change in isolation. It doesn't matter what it is you're talking about changing in your life. We can't do it in isolation. We need other people to assist us in that change. We need other people to validate us. We need other people to have security with. We need other people that we can feel vulnerable with as we're making change in our lives. And that might be people in our faith communities, someone trusted in your faith community. It might be your spouse, God, obviously. But we need an other in order to make change long-lasting. And it's a systemic interactional sequence. So that experience with another person takes two sides. Well, and we'll get that. The necessary, it takes two people, and so it really is about how they're interacting with one another. The necessary elements to move from self-protection and isolation to vulnerability and connection, you have to feel both safe and known. And so it has to take place in a relationship where you feel like you can take risks to make yourself known and that the other person is going to respond positively to that. Attunement, responsiveness, and engagement of the other. So if you're going to take that risk, if you are going to really express your fear, Your partner, if change is going to happen, needs to be attuned to that. They need to be there with you in the moment. They need to be listening. They need to be responsive and engaged in what it is that you're saying. And I think this can be scary for people on the receiving end because they often think, you know, there's some big answer that I have to give, or, you know, I have to have the answer to this, or there's something, you know, really profound that I have to say. And that's not it at all. Usually, the best way to be attuned and responsive to your partner when they're being vulnerable is often just to hold them, to say, I understand how you could feel that way. I didn't know that. You know, I'm sorry I missed it before, but I understand now. So they're simple things, but it seems like it would be an overwhelming process, but it's really not. We can do very simple things to make someone feel safe and secure in relationship to us. It is a collaborative interaction, and so it takes risk on the part of one person, and it takes attunement on the part of the other. And as one person is taking a risk and the other is attuned, then the other will take a risk and attunement will, so that, again, you form a positive cycle of interaction that way. And it involves the experience of feeling felt. So we really want to feel like someone else gets us. We want to feel like that person gets us, like they understand it, like it makes sense to them. Any questions so far, comments? I don't wanna.
There was just one comment I was gonna make on the last one. About the attunement, responsiveness,
yes,
and engagement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes being vulnerable it doesn't have to be about your relationship, but something else you're going through.
Right, yeah.
And one thing we had to work through was I would be pouring all this out, and his first reaction is, I'm gonna fix it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want it, I just wanted him to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And just let me get it
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah. That's what kind of sharing your burdens means, you know. Yeah.
Don't you even think so?
Well, I want him to listen. So that's not much to fix it.
Here's what you can say. I understand why you feel that way. It sounds like you're going through a really hard time.
I heard some songs.
That's a good one too. That's a good one too. So a couple of questions. I think that this is a process of kind of, as you create more security and more vulnerability in your marriage, it's a process of, it's a both a within, so within yourself, and also a between the two of you process. So it's bi-directional in that way. And so how do you create an environment of vulnerability and connection within? And so these are questions to reflect on for yourself as an individual. How do you react and respond in conflict? Like, what's your go-to automatic response? What do you tend to do? Do you tend to withdraw? Do you tend to really pursue? Do you get angry? What do you do? What do you do when there is danger or threat that you experience in your relationship? And that's informed by your dominant attachment style. You can probably look to those attachment styles and identify kind of where you fit and the types of things that you do in conflict and the types of things you do when you feel threatened in relationship. How do you try to get your needs met? Do you make clear requests about your having your needs met, or do you go about getting them in kind of more like passive aggressive types of ways? We all do that at times, but if you're not clearly expressing what you need or want from your partner, it's going to be difficult sometimes for them to interpret what you need. When do you operate out of that kind of reptilian brain? When do you allow your fight, flight, or fear response to take over and run wild with you? And when do you operate out of your prefrontal cortex? So when do you allow your, you know, when do you engage your human brain, if we want to call it that? And just notice those triggers that cause you to flip your lid, if you want to use that analogy. What are the triggers in your relationship that cause you to flip your lid? Learn more about what those triggers are for you. So in terms of kind of the within, I'm going to ask you all to do something, and this is where, next time. To experience, to try to kind of think about your own experiences and how it might be affecting your relationship. So, we're going to do this. So if everybody wants to close their eyes, I won't, you know, be watching you closely or anything, but I'm going to take you through this reflective experience. I want you to spend a minute. Think about a particularly difficult conflict or event in the history of your relationship. It might be a conflict that you seem to fight about over and over again, and you don't make any progress on it. It just comes up over and over. Maybe it was a crisis in your relationship that you didn't handle very well, and it's continued to impact you through the years. And with that experience in mind, I want you to think about these questions. How did you behave in those moments? What did you do? What were you thinking about your partner? Maybe you were thinking that your partner's unreliable, won't be there for you, or that your partner didn't understand. What were you thinking about yourself? As you think about that event or that experience, what was the first emotion you noticed yourself experiencing? Anxiety? Frustration, perhaps? Or anger? What other more vulnerable emotions did you experience in that moment? Perhaps fear, inadequacy, worthlessness. What basic fundamental needs did that experience touch on for you? A need for approval, a need to be perfect, a need to be lovable. You can go ahead and open your eyes when you're ready. So, these questions, the questions I ask as I ask you to think about, you know, a difficult event, these are the questions that will help you to gain self-awareness. So when you find yourself in a difficult conflict or having a difficult experience, a difficult time in your relationship, These are important questions to ask yourself and to reflect on that. And I have it, I'm going to flip ahead. I say take the elevator down because it's almost like, we'll go back. This is on the back. This is on your handout. But these, internally, it's almost like there's a hierarchy of depth, if you will. And so, generally speaking, what you see on the surface is someone's behavior, right? You see how they're behaving and how they're reacting in that moment. And so that's why I asked you to think about how did you behave? What did you do in response to that event? And then those behaviors are colored by our perceptions and our attributions. So what we think about our partner and what we think about ourselves. Like my partner's unreliable or my partner's lazy or my partner is not capable of loving or is cold and disconnected. And then thinking about, you know, yourself, I'm not worthy of being loved, I'm inadequate, those types of thoughts that we tend to have in difficult situations. Those perceptions and attributions are colored by secondary emotion. Secondary emotion is generally what we show people on the surface, and so that's what we see. So secondary emotions are generally things like anger, frustration. So they're outwardly expressed emotions. So you can pretty easily tell when someone's angry or when someone's, you know, frustrated and mad. However, secondary emotions are a response to primary emotion. And those primary emotions, those are the vulnerable emotions. So that's the fear of inadequacy. That's, you know, wondering if you're lovable, you know, worrying that people you're not worthy of love and acceptance. Those are the vulnerable emotions that we generally don't tell anyone we're experiencing. And then all of that is driven at the very bottom by unmet attachment needs. And those needs to be accepted and loved, needs to feel secure and safe. Those are common needs that we all, as humans, we have them. What usually happens in conflict in relationships is that people start here and they go up, and everything above this line is what we show to our partners. And we hide this. So we don't talk about our fears of, you know, we don't talk about our vulnerability, you know, we don't talk about how lonely we feel or how afraid we are that we're going to lose our partner or a fear of abandonment. We don't talk about how, you know, we need to feel safe and secure and loved. We don't talk about this stuff. We spend all of our time above the line, but spending our time above the line just perpetuates that cycle. And so it's getting below the line, and that's where the vulnerability comes in. It's getting below the line and having a willingness to share these two things that helps you to get out of a cycle of negativity and into a cycle of security and positivity in your relationship. Because if someone comes to you and says, you know, I'm really afraid of losing you, versus, I'm trying to think, versus, you're so inconsiderate and you're such a jerk and I don't want you, you know, going out with your friends after work with that woman I know has a crush on you at the office. Those are two really different emotional tones. This one is, what's below the line is really what expresses the deep truth there. And the deep truth is, I'm afraid of losing you, and that's terrifying to me. But generally, we don't say those sorts of things. We say the things above the line. We say you know, if you do that, you're just inconsiderate, and you're a jerk, and you don't respect my feelings. We do it in a kind of an attacking way. And that, so you could, how does someone respond if someone says, I'm afraid of losing you? How's your partner going to respond? More than likely. Yeah, they're going to be reassuring. They're probably going to be able to hear that more, right? Take it in, understand it. How do you respond if someone says, you're, you know, being an inconsiderate jerk, I don't want you doing that? What does that breed?
It's like telling
it breeds defensiveness. That's how, I mean, naturally, if we feel criticized or attacked, we naturally respond with defensiveness. Whereas if someone comes to you in a more vulnerable state and shares their primary emotions and their attachment needs associated with what's happening, it's much harder to respond defensively when someone's being vulnerable with you. So that's where both the risk and the response are really important. So that's the within. In terms of the process of change between, so this is what happens between the two of you. And I think I would encourage you, we don't have time now, but write these questions down and talk about them on your own. What do you need from your partner in order to take the risks necessary to build trust in your relationship? So maybe it seems like your partner is not very responsive or attuned to you. And so sometimes we need help. Sometimes we don't really know what our partner needs from us to feel safe. And it's okay to tell them. We need to help them, we need to take responsibility for helping them out in that way. I had an emotional breakdown the other night. Just lots of stress and stuff going on. I was just like sobbing. And my husband, poor guy, but he was like, "What is happening? Like, what's going on? What are you doing? You never do this. This is so totally uncharacteristic of you." And he was like, "Well, you probably shouldn't check your email or something. Like, you probably shouldn't check your work email at home." So he's trying to like fix it. And it just like made me cry more. And so I like went into the bedroom. This is my withdrawal. So I like go into the bedroom, and then I was just like in there like crying for like 10 or 15 minutes. And finally, I was like, he doesn't know what to do. So I went back and I went out there and I said, as I'm sobbing, "I just need you to hold me." That's all. I just need you to hold me. Can you just hold me? And so, he pulled me into on his lap and held me like a little baby. So this is like my self-disclosure time here, but don't tell anybody else. That's on recording. Yeah, it is. It's on tape. But he didn't know what to do. I mean, I had to ask for that, and I had to tell him what I needed in that moment. And so he just, sometimes we're not always completely tuned in, and we don't know what to do. So, let your partner know. Give him a hand. Ask them what you need in order to build trust and security in the relationship. Let your partner know about what your own internal process is. So as you've thought about your own internal, kind of what happens for you in those moments, share that with your partner. When this happens, when these types of conflicts happen, or when you do this, it triggers this type of response in me. How does your partner's internal process affect your ability to be vulnerable? Maybe your partner gets very critical under stress, and so that makes it hard for you to share. So talk about those things. What can you do to show your partner that you're trustworthy? So how can you show them that it's safe? That you're willing and able to hold their vulnerability and to allow them to be vulnerable, and that you're not going to be rejecting, and that you're not going to be dismissive of that, but that you're going to be accepting and attuned and responsive when they share those things with you. And then there was that. So, it really is through that type of, it's not really weakness, and so to say, and weakness made strong, because I think it is, I mean, it's a play on words, and vulnerability really is about strength, but it's really in that vulnerability and in that weakness, if you will, that we can protect our relationships and strengthen them. And that's what, I mean, I really and truly believe, and I think that research would support me in saying this, but I think that's really what distinguishes between those couples who have lifelong, committed, stable, but also happy and secure relationships from those who don't, is the quality of the safety of the bond and the quality of their security and their willingness to take risks and be vulnerable. So, do y'all have other questions or comments or anything? Yeah. There's some, if you're interested in, I don't remember. I guess not. There are some books out there in the bookstore. If you're interested in reading kind of more about some of these ideas, a couple of books are out there by Sue Johnson. She's a marriage and family therapist. She doesn't write from a Christian perspective, but she writes a lot about kind of this idea of attachment style in our neuroscience and how they connect and impact our intimate relationships. So there are two books out there by her. One's called Love Sense. It's more scientific, if you're interested in that. And then one's called Hold Me Tight, which is a little bit more practical in terms of, you know, how can you incorporate some of these ideas into your relationship. And that's a great book because it has, each chapter has questions for discussion between partners and then also some exercises. And so it's really a great resource. If you're more interested or really interested in learning about kind of interpersonal neuroscience and how our brains work in relationship to one another and are interested in a kind of faith perspective on that, there's a book called The Anatomy of the Soul his name is slipping my mind. I think it's Kurt something, but I can't remember his last name. I don't think that one's out there, but it's a really good book, and it talks about some of these same things, like how do we establish, what do we know about our brains, how our brains interact with other brains, and how we establish security in relationships. And so it's a really good read too. So, all right. Thank you all. Thank you.